Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the June 24th, 2012 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Well, Tropical Storm Debbie sits off our Gulf Coast today, so on this rainy Sunday afternoon, I invite you to stay inside for the next hour as we touch on a variety of topics about our nation's space program, especially today, helium-3, which, depending on your point of view, is either completely worthless or a veritable gold mine waiting on the moon for us that could solve all of our energy needs on planet Earth. I hope that's enticing for you. My guest today will be Homer Hickam, the former NASA engineer who wrote the best-selling book Rocket Boys, which was then turned into the movie October Sky. He's got a new book out called Crater, and guess what? That's right. It's all about mining helium-3 on the moon. Well, it's not all about it. We'll talk about it. We'll also preview this week's scheduled Delta IV heavy launch from the Cape, and we'll be happy to answer your questions about the space program or debate any space-related topic with you during the program today. Our phone number is 768-1240. The area code is 321 if you need it. And our email address, if you prefer to send us an email, is spacetalking@aol.com. Well, let's get started with today's edition of my weekly broadcast blog, Orbital Inclinations. Jill Tarter retired this past week. That name may not be as familiar to you as Neil Armstrong or John Glenn, but she is famous enough with a certain segment of the space community that she had a movie made about her work. Tarter was the inspiration for the main character in Carl Sagan's classic book Contact, which was made into a movie by the same name that starred Jodie Foster. Of course, the topic of the book and movie and the focus of Tarter's career was the search for intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. SETI, as it is known for short, is one of those space-related topics that I think everyone is interested in, has some opinion about, but way too often is too afraid to discuss seriously for fear of not being taken seriously. The subject of intelligent aliens is usually left for late-night talk radio and is usually clumped together with talk of JFK and 911 conspiracy theories or the latest UFO or even Elvis sightings. If you're not familiar with the storyline of Contact, the basics are that Ellie Arroway, the Jill Tarter-based character, is using radio telescopes to listen for signals from deep space that are not naturally produced. Now, assuming the laws of nature are universal in this universe, all intelligent life would understand math in the same manner. So an excellent way to announce your presence would be to broadcast a series of prime numbers at a certain frequency that is relevant to our understanding of, let's say, chemistry. Prime numbers, as you may recall from elementary school, are special numbers that can only be divided by one and themselves. So 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17, 19, and so on. Well, they're all prime numbers. Now, because of their unique mathematical relationship, you would not expect any naturally occurring phenomenon to be able to generate a radio signal at a specific frequency that included prime numbers, unless it originated from an intelligent form of life. So in the book and the movie Contact, such a signal is heard on Earth and, well, drama ensues. Now, I encourage you to read the book and watch the movie if you've never done so. It will definitely challenge you to think about what you believe and why about science, our place in the universe, and even the existence of God. You know, the fact that science and religion is intertwined in this story is really inescapable, interestingly enough. Despite the fact that Carl Sagan was clearly a skeptic and agnostic, there were strong pro-religious themes in both the book and the movie, including a very enticing development in the book, but not included in the movie, that offered proof of God's existence buried within the value of pi. You'll have to go read the book to find out what it is. Dot Contact, both book and movie, definitely challenged the way I think about the universe. The book definitely belongs on every self-respecting space cadet's bookshelf, and the movie remains on my personal list of top 10 favorite flicks of all time, and not just because parts of the movie were filmed at the Kennedy Space Center press site, and you can see the trailer where I worked in several scenes. Now, what I like most about Contact, and really the work Jill Tarter and SETI are doing for real, is that in challenging my thoughts about such things, it only reinforces what I already personally believe in several ways. You know, first, I definitely believe there is some form of extraterrestrial life out there somewhere. It may be nothing more than bacteria, or perhaps there are giant dinosaurs in another world. Here, it seems size doesn't matter. But it may be close as microbes on Mars, for example, or even small fish hidden within the ice-encrusted oceans of Jupiter's moon Europa. You know, I am hopeful there is intelligent life out there. If we humans are an accident of random mutations in evolution and not the product of an intelligent designer, well then, given the billions of worlds that must be circling the trillions of stars that are out there, there has got to be a statistically high probability that some form of intelligent life has evolved somewhere else. On the other hand, if there is an intelligent designer in the universe, as I believe, then what better proof could there be for God's existence than to learn we here on Earth are the only form of intelligent life anywhere in the universe? That to be created in God's image makes us all the more special. Well, now, we may or may not ever find scientifically verifiable proof that we are or are not alone in the universe, or even that God does or does not exist. It's enough for me that I have faith that both are true, and that my curiosity about what's out there constantly drives me to learn more, not only about my universe, but my God. Now, add these questions to the reasons why I think it's a good idea for us to have a space program that seeks out knowledge to help us better understand the answers to our most fundamental questions about life, both physical and spiritual. Jill Tarter spent 30 years listening for signs of intelligent life out there. Let's make sure we do the intelligent thing back here and continue that quest. And that's this week's Orbital Inclinations. Well, look, before we take our first break, I do want to update you on the progress being made by the Chinese in Earth orbit right now. As we mentioned last week, the Shenzhou 9 spacecraft launched with three astronauts aboard, including China's first female crew member. Their ship performed an automatic docking with the Tiangong-1 mini space lab last week, but very early this very morning, they undocked with the prototype space station and then manually redocked a short time later. This manual docking is another in a series of big deals for the Chinese space program. And yes, we've already done it before, so aren't we just the greatest thing since sliced bread? But once again, China is showing the world that, well, they are making advances. And like I said last week, we should not be dismissing this with a been there, done that attitude. We ignore China's success at our own peril. Well, anyway, coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to be joined on the phone by Homer Hickam. A little later, we'll preview this week's planned launch of a Delta IV. Don't forget to give us a call, 321-768-1240. Send us an email to spacetalking@AOL.com with your questions or comments. Hey, please stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break. I'll be right back. I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. listen to Space Talk on the web at WMMBAM.com.
And welcome back to Space Talk, everyone. 321-768-1240, the number to call to participate in the program today. You can also give us a shout on email to spacetalking@AOL.com. Well, as it turns out today, the today's edition of this program marks the beginning of my fourth year of doing Space Talk here on WMMB. The first show was on June 20th, 2009. And, of course, I did take about 6 months off last year while I was sick, but happy to be on the air for this extended time. By the way, we do have planning to have Homer Hickam on the show today. We are having a little problem getting a hold of him right now. We talked to him a few minutes ago, and we're just trying to get it all hooked up here on the phone, so we'll have him with us shortly. A lot of people have asked me recently, you know, about Space Talk and about WMMB and kind of how that all began, and maybe now's a good time to reminisce a little bit while we work on getting Homer on the phone. Way back when WMMB was a nostalgia format radio station, back when Larry Brewer was kind of the main program guy around here, you know, it'd be one of these shows that I listened to on the way to work in the morning when I was at Florida Today, and you'd hear, you know, Tony Bennett and Frank Sinatra and Barbara Streisand and all of that. And so every once in a while, folks would call into the program and ask a space-related question about something that's happening, and Larry would feign a little ignorance. Actually, he was a little ignorant about everything, having to do with space anyway. And so it became, you know, one of these times where I called in once and said, well, here's the answer to this question. You know, I figured I would try to get a little free plug for the paper or something like that. That kind of phoning in with some questions, some answers to questions, evolved this great relationship that Larry and I had and involved this great relationship that we ultimately had with WMMB. As we continue to become more and more a part of the family here, we eventually got to the point where, and this was probably about 12, 15, 13, maybe even 15 years ago, we decided that we would start trying to do live launch coverage of every launch. It was something that MMB hadn't done for a while. And so I kind of had the expertise to do it and the willingness to do it, and WMMB was willing to do it as well. And so this began this relationship. So very early on, we started doing we would be out at the press site, and we'd just call it in and say, here's what's happening, and we'd do the 3-2-1 liftoff and all that. And then over the years, it kind of evolved, become a little more sophisticated as the whole internet thing started exploding and we had access to more and more information. For a long time, when I worked for space.com, I had my own satellite dish out in the backyard of the Well, hang on. We'll just I'm going to check something here. Sean is asking me a question, and I'm going to tell him that what he has is wrong. The last number is a 6, not a 7. So that's the problem. Okay, Sean? The last number is a 6, not a 7. And then that way you won't get what you're getting, and you'll be okay. All right? So we'll finish this story, and then we'll probably get Homer on pretty quick. All right, so we had our own satellite dish, and so we could tune into the broadcast. See, way back when, in fact, it still continues today, all the commercial launches are broadcast on a C-band satellite. So we had this big dish that you could point at, and which was really great because not only could you get the live launch coverage directly from the company without having to go through cable channel or anything like that, it also lets you see the preseason games of the Minnesota Vikings in the summer, which was just incredibly fun. So we'd be up there every August, you know, eating popcorn and eating brats in the office, watching the games on satellite. Well, anyway, so this evolved over the years. Now, as the station changed its formatting from time to time and finally became talk, and then finally with Bill Mick coming on board, again, in 2009, just a little bit before that, in the spring, we said, you know, with Shuttle kind of winding down and the future really looking exciting at that time, I think it's still exciting, but we had a lot of plans for some neat things back then, going back to the moon and on to Mars. The decision was made, that, and they approached me and said, well, let's do a show, a weekly show about the space program. And so we talked about it. We talked to some friends in the space community. We got some sponsors. And from all that experience and from that all relationship, you know, Space Talk is born. So a lot of people ask me, are you an actual employee of the radio station? Or do you work here? I said, no, I don't. We just come in and do the show once a week, and we have a relationship with Bill and the station and all the gang here. And that's kind of how it all started 4 years ago. And so, again, today marks the beginning of our fourth year. We started 3 years ago, and like I said, we took some time off. But now we're here and ready to go. So speaking of being ready to go, with a few minutes left here, we do have some time to get to this. I do want to introduce our guest today. I kind of knew from the very beginning when we started doing Space Talk 3 years ago that eventually I would have Homer Hickam on the show. Now, believe it or not, Homer and I have never actually shook hands, although our paths have crossed a few times during the during our mutual careers. And the truth is, I've always been a little jealous of Homer because he's actually done what I've always wanted to do, which is to write some best-selling books. In fact, he's written a few. Now, his first book, Rocket Boys, was released in 1989, and 10 years later turned into the movie October Sky. And like The Right Stuff and Apollo 13 and Contact, I guess, since I already mentioned that earlier in the program, October Sky is one of those must-see movies if you're at all interested in the space program. Homer has a new book out called Crater, which we'll let him tell us about as he joins us now on the phone from his home in Huntsville. Homer, great to finally have you on our program, sir. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Jim, and congratulations on your fourth anniversary. I think that is really, really great. And, you know, you can yet write that best-selling novel, memoir, whatever it is that you want to write. It's like when sometimes kids ask me, well, Mr. Hickam, are you sorry you never went into space? And I go, well, I'm not dead yet.
I'm not dead yet.
Always a possibility.
Well, you know, I've got at least two or three good books. I mean, you know, there's so many stories. You know, as you know, being kind of exposed to the media through your career, you know, there's so many things that go on behind the scenes of our space program, and not only in the media world, but even just in the operational side of things that we never hear about and are so fascinating. And then, like I say, there's all sorts of to books to be written. But let's talk about you for a second. Let's remind everyone kind of where you hail from. I know that you spent, about 17 years at NASA. Did you spend all of them there in Huntsville at Marshall, or did you get around a little bit?
I did, although certainly various TDYs brought me down to the Cape. I saw at least a half dozen shuttle launches while I was down there. I was also involved at KSC with integrating payloads, primarily space lab payloads.
Okay.
And so, and I loved being down at the Cape. When I was down there, of course, I'm a history buff, and I was, you know, still around very much when the space race started back in 1957. I was in high school then. And to go down the Cape and to actually, I'd go out jogging in the morning and go running past the blockhouse and the pad where, you know, John Glenn was launched into orbit.
Sure.
And over here was where the Jupiter C put our first satellite into orbit. And over there was these marvelous, huge concrete structures with abandoned in place, which
right.
made me kind of unhappy to see those. But still,
right.
I just felt like I was part of history and seeing history and reliving it in a way when I was down at the Cape.
Well, that's great. And I know in your involvement here, I was really interested to see that you were involved in doing some astronaut training at some point, too. You know, you're involved in the original satellite rescue mission Solar Max and the Hubble Space Telescope servicing and early work on the space station. And, I mean, you really kind of hit the highlights there.
I was a scuba instructor. I became a scuba instructor back in 1973, even before I started working for NASA. So when I did start working for NASA, one of the first things I did was to volunteer to go work over in the neutral buoyancy simulator, which was 40 foot deep, 80 feet across, cylindrical tank where we trained the astronauts to do a variety of missions in their suits. They call it, you know, EVA, extravehicular activities. And I was involved very much with training the crew for the Solar Max and then later for the Hubble Space Telescope, which is fodder for a novel itself. To my mind, the rescue that Story Musgrave and the crew effected on the Hubble Space Telescope was NASA's finest moment since Apollo 17.
You know, and I really believe, too, that I remember covering that overnight, all those five spacewalks, thinking that, you know, the hype going into this, you know, we were coming out of hydrogen leaks and we were coming out and there was Hubble and the space station was in jeopardy in Congress. And, you know, if Hubble's servicing hadn't been successful, I truly believe we would not have had a space station.
No, I agree. And again, we have to give credit to the crew here, in this case, Story and Kathy Thornton and some of the others, in their training. We had a training established, and I think that training would have worked, but Story insisted that we train precisely like the repair would be done. That meant that they went down and stayed underwater for like 8 hours.
Right.
That meant they went into decompression, which is a dangerous situation, as you know. Living down there, I'm sure you're aware with the bends
sure.
can occur. That meant to avoid decompression for the crew, we had to pump a highly percentage of oxygen down to them, nitrox, which made it dangerous that they might even catch on fire underwater.
Yeah.
So we had some real, real technical difficulties to overcome, but we did it. We hurt some divers in the process, but their story has never been told.
Mm-hmm.
But we went up and saved that that daggone Hubble Space Telescope. And my goodness, what a wonderful instrument it's been.
That's absolutely. Hey, Homer, I apologize for the late start. We're going to get right to Crater and the rest of your literary
okay.
work when we come back. Everyone, we're going to stand by, pause for our 5-minute built-in hold here. Get you caught up in the latest news, weather, and sports, especially with that tropical storm out there. When we return, we will continue our discussion with Homer Hickam, talk about his new book, Crater. Meanwhile, dial 321-768-1240. If you'd like to make a question or comment, email thespacetalking@aol.com. Stand by. We'll be right back. I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Bankey.
Indeed, welcome back to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB. By the way, I took a quick look at the National Weather Service tropical storm update for 2 o'clock. Debbie is essentially just west of us now over the Gulf, moving a little faster northeast at 6 miles an hour. Winds are at 60 miles an hour, slight higher gusts, slight strengthening possible during the next couple of days. They don't really have a good idea where it's going to go after the next 12 to 24 hours or so. And tropical storm force winds extend out up to 200 miles. So we're right on the edge of it, making for a nasty day here. Homer Hickam, safe in Huntsville, Alabama, our guest today on the program. We're so glad to have you with us, sir. Homer, we're talking
Sorry about the rain down there, but we could use some up here. So
we can always use some rain around here, too. It just makes for a wet Sunday.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, we're talking about your NASA career and all things. I'm curious, when during all of this did you start thinking putting together Rocket Boys, which, of course, was the big hit and still is a big deal for students all around the world, it seems, who read it in school?
Yeah, Rocket Boys, I guess, is my classic. What happened, how I came to write Rocket Boys was, I'd actually had another book published, people don't know that necessarily, but it was called Torpedo Junction, which is about the U-boat wars up and down the East Coast. It was a bestseller way back in 1989, and then I hadn't written anything, and didn't really have any plans to write anything in a longer form, but I wrote a short article for Smithsonian Air and Space Magazine about when I was a kid living in Colwood, West Virginia, a mining
sure.
town, and I built rockets, and it got such a big response. Publishers, New York publishers, started calling me and asking me if I would write a memoir about it or if I was planning on doing it, and I said, well, I guess I am now. So that's how it came
and
about.
The rest became history. You know, the thing I always wanted to ask you about growing up and doing model rockets, you know, I did the exact same thing in Minnesota. This is where my dad's hoping I tell the Honest John model rocket story, which I'm not going to do. Sorry, Dad. But, you know, I always use, you know, I always use the Estes engines, prefabricated and, you know, an NAR safety code and all that. You were a little more daring in putting together some propellant, and it seemed to be much more, I guess, scientific in that way.
Well, I was in the right place in the right time to do that. We were inspired by Sputnik, the world's first Earth satellite. We boys in this little coal town. And there were no Estes rocket engines or anything like that, or
yeah.
we probably scraped up enough money to bought them, and there wouldn't have been a good story then.
That's right.
So we recruited a young man by the name of Quentin, who was a prototypical nerd of all time, and Quentin gave us what he called rigor. It wasn't good enough that we figured out how to build a rocket. We had to know how they worked and why they worked.
Sure.
And so we started with, like most people, experimented with rockets with black powder. We never did very much with that, and aluminum tubing. And then we graduated. Because we had access to my dad's coal mine machine shop, And very enthusiastic machinist who, on the sly when my dad wasn't looking, loved to work on our rockets. We graduated on up to potassium nitrate and sugar. We melted it. We called it rocket candy. This was hot stuff. And
yeah.
Ultimately, we went to zinc dust and sulfur using a solvent of pure alcohol that we got from the local bootlegger. And with those rockets, and with Quentin pushing us to understand what we were doing, we had a book that our science teacher, high school science teacher, Miss Riley, gave us called Principles of Guided Missile Design that I later saw in a PhD program for rocketry, and it required a working knowledge of calculus and differential equations. And when we started, I was having a lot of trouble with just algebra. But we taught ourselves all that stuff, and ultimately our rockets were breaking the we're going supersonic within a half second of launch and going up to 5 and 6 miles in altitude.
You know, during this time when you were growing up and doing all this, to what extent were you aware of even Huntsville at that time, and especially of Wernher von Braun and all the work he was doing?
Well, not at all of Huntsville. I knew Wernher von Braun, and he was, of course, the big hero to a lot of kids back then, and he was held up as the space scientist who's going to save us. In a lot of ways, I guess he did.
Yeah.
I always thought he was at the Cape.
Oh, really?
And so it was my ambition to join him down at the Cape. Now, Vietnam got in the way of that. When I graduated from college, for the next 6 years, I was either getting ready to go to Vietnam or in Vietnam or recovering from Vietnam.
Yeah, yeah.
So by then, the Apollo Moon program was pretty much done, and it took me some years. I was 38 years old when I finally got to work for NASA.
Okay.
But I was hired at Marshall Space Flight Center, where the Von Braun team used to be, and had an absolutely marvelous career here.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I had the same experience in Minnesota growing up, Homer, where I thought everything happened at the Cape, too. I mean, when I found out that the astronauts didn't live in Cocoa Beach like on I Dream of Jeannie, that they were in Houston. It was just such a disappointment, you know?
That? How come they're not at the beach?
And why aren't they here all the time?
Opinion. That's exactly right.
Well, commercial crew is here now, so at least we're making, you know.
Well, you know, we know it was the politics of Lyndon Johnson that took the crew over to Houston.
Sure.
And I love the folks down in Houston, too. I spent a lot of time, since I did train the astronauts, I spent a lot of time down there, and absolutely, you know, thought that the folks in Houston did a great job. We were a little bit competitive with them there in Huntsville.
Right.
But still, it was a great time to work for NASA. The shuttle era was an absolutely marvelous time to work for NASA. But the shuttle hung on, actually, I think, for probably a little bit too long. But without a replacement, there was really no choice, and
right.
I was sorry to see it go when it did.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We feel very much the same way, that the shuttle was ready to be replaced. We just wish we had the replacement. But, you know, there are some neat things looking forward, and this was so amazing about your book, Crater. You know, and I don't know if you just were smart, lucky, or prescient, or what, but, you know, commercial operations in space and mining helium-3, and then you've got Planetary Resources made their announcement after your book came out. Mining helium-3, solar power satellites, going after asteroids have always been the big ticket space future items.
Yeah, there's a lot to do in space, Jim. And of course, I don't necessarily give a brief for helium-3. I hope that helium-3 works out. When I wrote Crater, what I wanted to do basically was to set up a society, a civilization there on the moon, and write about it through the eyes of my 16-year-old protagonist. He's
right.
A boy named Crater. He works in a helium-3 mine. Certainly, I think, I mean, based upon what Harrison Schmitt, one of the last two men on the moon, believes, that there is a very strong possibility that helium-3 will be used in the future in fusion reactors back here on Earth. And I can certainly see that. But right now, of course, energy is relatively cheap. With oil and natural gas and even nuclear reactors compared to fusion. But I think eventually it will become economically feasible and perhaps an imperative to go to the moon and create a civilization there and mine helium-3 and other things. We believe actually on the moon, you know, when you talk about mining asteroids, the fact is it's tough to mine asteroids. They have no gravity, essentially no gravity, and trying to get rocks off of them and transport it back to the Earth, I think, is going to be pretty difficult. But actually, there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of asteroids on the moon. I mean, take a look at it. It's just so pocked with where asteroids have hit it. And some of those are rather large asteroids that are probably intact. And I'm writing Crater 2 right now. and where they find an asteroid made almost out of pure nickel, and we think there are a lot of those probably, and laced with gold. So there's a lot of it was a lot of fun with Crater to invent this civilization. Crater is a helium-3 miner. He's only 16. He started mining when he was 12 years old. There's no child labor laws on the moon
right.
that I envision in the 22nd century. As a matter of fact, it's a wild frontier. It's not a government-operated outfit. It's a bunch of entrepreneurs, really tough guys, that are up there and set up these moon towns and. And they're basically, their word is law. And
yeah,
so it's a lot like the town where I grew up, as a matter of fact, in West Virginia.
I was going to say, a lot of reviewers, a lot of the folks have written about your book saying it's really almost more of a Western than anything else.
It is, I like that comparison. It's a raw frontier where the sheriff works for the guy who owns the company and owns the town. So he pretty much keeps the law according to the colonel, in this case. That owns the town where Crater lives. Crater sent on a 1,000-mile journey across the moon. I had a lot of I did a lot of research and trying to figure out how he would make that journey, what he might encounter along the way. It's a journey, a very dangerous journey, where a lot of people are trying to kill him, and he can't understand why. But it's because the colonel has sent him on this mission to pick up a package on the other end there, but didn't tell him that two other men had already been killed doing it. But since he's an orphan and he's kind of expendable, that's why the colonel sends him off on this this wild and woolly adventure across the moon and ultimately into space.
Yeah, and I want you to talk a little bit about the book itself in terms of, you know, I didn't know until I started reading it, Homer, that it was essentially intended for young adults. It's kind of a young reader, but really it's something that everyone, I think, is very approachable to everybody. But you had kids in mind when you wrote it.
I did. It is a young adult genre, but I read a few of that before I started writing it, and to my mind, they're every bit as good as just general fiction. The only difference that I really took in the process of writing it was that my protagonist, Crater, is 16 going on 17,
yeah.
And some of the other characters in there are young as well. But since it's set 120 years in the future, I don't have to worry about what kids today think because I have no clue what they think. But I just hope that they think that they want to read my book.
Yeah, that's good. And with about a minute before we have to take our next break, I wanted to highlight the fact that you named your colonel after John Medaris, and I've seen the name in some of your other works as well. Medaris was a great figure here at the Cape, of course. Did you get to know him? Did you meet him? How has that come about?
I never got to meet him, unfortunately, but of course he was Von Braun's boss,
right?
And when he worked for the Army Ballistic Missile Agency. But what I read about him made me really, really admire him. So in the book that I wrote back in the 2000 called Back to the Moon, that starred Jack Medaris, who obviously I named after General Medaris. And I've just continued that with Crater. Crater is kind of an extension of the world view that I created back in, with Back to the Moon, only now everything that Jack Medaris hoped would happen did, but not necessarily the way that he wanted it.
The way he wanted to. Hey, Homer, stand by for a minute. We're going to take our final break of the day. When we do come back, we'll wrap up our discussions for the week. Plus, take a look at the local launch forecast. I'm Jim Behnke, and you are listening to Space Talk right here on a rainy Sunday afternoon on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. This is Space Talk with Jim Behnke.
Welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk. With a quick reminder, you can stay in touch with us throughout the week. If you're on Facebook, just search for Space Talk. If you're using Twitter, we're Space Talking. And for one-stop shopping about the program, just visit WMMBAM.com and enter keywords Space Talk. As we continue along with our program, we will now take a moment and take a look at our weekly look at the local launch forecast. You know, launches always seem to come in bunches around here on the heels of last Wednesday's Atlas V launch. United Launch Alliance is preparing to send a Delta IV Heavy into orbit on Thursday. The launch period for the National Reconnaissance Office mission is 5:30 to 10:30 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, which means the launch time We'll be somewhere between those two times. Now, we won't learn about the actual launch window until later in the week, and the first official weather forecast won't be released until tomorrow. Now, hopefully by that time, Tropical Storm Debbie will be clearly out of the picture. For now, the National Weather Service extended forecast for Thursday looks generally favorable for a rocket launch in the morning, but we'll learn more about that tomorrow. As you may know, the Delta IV Heavy is a particularly large beast, one that I'm still nervous about every time it flies. All the more so this time because this shot will include upgraded main engines at the bottom of each of the three core boosters that make up the first stage. We'll be talking about more than 2.1 million pounds of thrust, so it's going to be a pretty spectacular sight. We will have live launch coverage of the shot here on WMMB, very likely during the Bill Mick Live program. We'll begin just a few minutes before liftoff as usual. If there are any changes to the launch time once we know it, as the countdown progresses on that Thursday, we'll be sure to pass the information along to Bill to share with you on the air. Of course, you can listen to streaming audio on the web at WMMBAM.com or on your mobile devices via iHeartRadio. And quickly, while we're on the topic of launches, I did forget to mention last week that the KSC launch time did actually finally successfully send the New Star X-ray telescope into Earth orbit on June 13th. That Pegasus launch that we've been talking about, staged from the Kwajalein Atoll in the Pacific, all went well. In fact, this past Thursday, the satellite did finally deploy and fully deploy the main appendage that would allow the X-ray telescope to work. So the mission is going very well. So once again, the next launch is a Delta IV Heavy on this Thursday, sometime between 5:30 and 10:30 in the morning. For more information about this and all the various launches scheduled around the world, jump on the web to WMMBAM.com, keyword space talk. Look for the link to our launch forecast. Homer Hickam is joining us from Huntsville today to talk about his new book, Crater. Homer, we've got a couple more minutes to go here. Just to give a sense of some of the really neat things that are in this thing, you know, I've been reading through the book and enjoying it very much. I got to admit, I haven't gotten quite to the end yet. But one of the main things, almost a character in this thing, is called, and I hope I'm saying it right, is it Gilly or is it Jilly? It's got to be Gilly.
It's a Gilly.
Which is
illegal, but it knows that.
And that's the line. It's illegal and it knows it. And it's, I cannot picture in my head, no matter how many times you describe it in the book, what this thing looks like and how it works.
I never describe it. I want everybody to come up with their own concept of the Gilly. The Gilly is a biological computer that the Crater has. There's only one left in the world, or the moon in this case, and they're all illegal. They're sneaky, but they can do just an awful lot of things, and it is kind of Crater's advisor. It is made out of slime mold cells. You ever go look at slime mold cells in Wikipedia, you'd be surprised at what slime mold cells do.
Yeah.
But a gilly can see you. It doesn't have any eyes. It can talk to you. It doesn't have a mouth.
Yeah.
It listens to you. It doesn't have any ears. It shrugs, but it doesn't have any shoulders. And it runs, but it doesn't have any legs. So, you know, a gilly's a gilly. But unfortunately, they're illegal. But thank goodness it knows that.
Well, you know, and I'm just waiting for the movie to be made. Like, who's going to star as the gilly? Or is it, thank God for CGI effects, you know?
Well, in the audio, I was kind of interested to see how in the audio tape, how the narrator would come up with for the gilly. He actually used Stephen Hawking's voice.
Oh, really?
Which I thought that was pretty imaginative to do.
That actually kind of makes a little sense to me. So Crater, how's it doing, by the way? How's it been received in terms of, I mean, I'm sure no one would tell you that it is no good to your face, right?
Sure they would.
They would
love to do that. But no, it's been received very, very well, enough so that the publisher has asked for two more of them. So it's
right.
Going to be a trilogy. And I'm almost finished with the second in the trilogy now. And I've had a lot of fun with it. And as a writers like to write in different, or at least I do. I like to write in different genres. And I've written the memoirs, of course, I'm best known for. But
right.
Also I've written World War II adventure stories, the Josh Thurlow series. I've written historicals. But the young adult science fiction is kind of a throwback to one of my favorite writers. It's Heinlein.
Sure.
Back in the 1950s, in the golden age of sci-fi. So I had an opportunity really to write in his genre, if you will, and to create characters that I think that that Heinlein would have been proud to create and write about, too. So I hope the young people will not only read Crater, but also maybe go read some of the stuff from the golden age of sci-fi.
And, Homer, with about a minute left, you know, you not only are you writing in different genres, but you're writing for different formats. You've started this Kindle series of I guess, short books or short stories. I don't know how to describe it, but you talk about Paco the cat who meowed in space.
Yeah, my mom, Elsie Hickam, didn't raise any fools. You know, Amazon is the great big bear right now in the publishing world, and they asked for me to write something for their short form. It's called a Kindle single. So I wrote Paco the cat who meowed in space, and Paco was my cat who actually saved a NASA mission by meowing in space, the first cat to ever meow in space, and therein hangs the tale. And there's more in there, too. I knew Krista McCalla from the Challenger disaster, and I wrote, and I was also on the Challenger redesign team. So in Paco, the cat meowing in space, I tell, from our perspective, what really happened in the Challenger accident and some other things. Now, I think that people that are involved in the space program for a long, long time might be surprised at that was going on here during the whole shuttle era.
So not just a lighthearted cat adventure for little kids, but some really good history there.
Some really good history, but at the same time, if you love cats, you love space, hey, it's the book
It's the book for you. Homer, thanks for so much for taking time to be on the show today on a Sunday afternoon, and it was a great chance to finally talk with you. I know our paths will cross again, and someday we will actually shake hands.
Well, thanks, Jim. HomerHickam.com is where people can go for more.
I appreciate it very much,
sir. All right, buddy.
Take care now, okay? Take care. So there goes Homer Hickam, truly a great guy, and I encourage you all to pick up his stuff. You can go to our website, WMNBAM.com, keyword space talk. I'll be putting links up to his site and to the books. Hey, next Sunday marks the 50th anniversary of the official establishment of what we now know for as the Kennedy Space Center. We're going to take a walk down memory lane and spend some time celebrating the past, talking about the future of America's Rocket Ranch. Also coming up in 2 weeks on July 15th, we will be joined by a current KSC director and fellow Minnesota native, Bob Cabana. So anyway, that's what's coming up. Don't forget to keep an eye on us at WMNBAM.com, keyword Space Talk, where you can find all that you need to know. That's it for now. Space Talk, a production of Mylas Solutions, and is brought to you thanks to the generous help of our supporting sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technology, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. My thanks to Sean Williams for manning the op station for today's program. Join us next Sunday, 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight, for another live hour of Space Talk. Stay tuned now for the best of Bill Mick Live. I'm Jim Behnke. Hey, we'll talk to you again Thursday morning for that Delta IV heavy launch. Stay tuned for that. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again real soon.